My Life as an Animal, Serialization, Week 6. This episode is brought to you by animalaid.org.uk, who campaign peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promote cruelty-free living.
It's now time to continue our audiobook here on UK Health Radio, My Life as an Animal, written by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith.
My Life as an Animal.
During the long school holidays, Sarah would drop off Davy at nearby Fleet Community Centre. Here, kids could run around and bellow, but also do useful stuff that channeled their lava flows of energy. Sarah always had two, sometimes three, part-time jobs on the go. And without Fleet or similar, her holding pattern for life with a child would head for a crash landing. For the six-week summer project of 1979, Fleet were looking for more adult help. Sarah thought of me. I was game, even though the days were long. It was alien country, and I'd be offering my services for free. Free, I guess, was all right. Who knew what big oak might spring from this little acorn of a chance? I met the project leader, Anne Stewart, who turned out to have uncanny ability for capturing and holding young children's attention. She could also do the bureaucracy thing. Our meeting went well, and so did my first week. At the end of it, I was asked to stay for the remaining five, for which I would be paid. When the painting, nature trips, pottery music, games, and quiet readings were done, I was left with the memory of some shrewd and funny kids, and I was reminded that where learning is concerned, the process is two ways. I said something to that effect in a short colour piece about my Fleet adventure I wrote for the now-defunct New Society magazine. By short, I meant single column, about 2 inches long. I'd sold similar epics to The New Statesman and to NME since leaving AdVision. There was one on a right-wing anarchist grouping, another on an apparent English folk music boom. I even did a two-page history of Rastafarianism for a grow-as-you-go encyclopedia whose parts were purchased in weekly instalments. They wanted it done dry and expressionless so that it could pass as middle-brow anthropology, and it wasn't to favour a particular political perspective because of prevailing tensions. By the time I'd met their terms, it didn't favour being read. There was another project that suddenly came my way that was a challenge unlike any other I'd taken on. It concerned a group of young men aged 15 to 17 who were regular evening visitors to the Fleet Centre but had no interest in the well-attended night classes and workshops. Instead, they indulged in mischievous wanderings that would take them accidentally into a woman's weight loss class, for instance. There would be smirking and maybe a fake sincere request for information about the class, mixed in with scatological references to uncontrolled urination. They knew precisely how to calibrate what was intended to menace with what was meant to confuse. Several times they had been banned from the place. The police had been called repeatedly, but they would plead hard times, be given another chance, and the menace and mischief would start again. The crunch came when a regular emerged from his Wednesday evening yoga class, feeling balanced and refreshed, and was met by a fist in the face from one of the troublesome youths. Of course, they were adamant with their denials, and the shaken victim refused to register a complaint. Anne told me she would keep the group off the premises for 2 weeks, even if it meant hiring extra security. There would then be a final attempt at integration, something she would like to put me onto. Through an approachable member of the group called Mark, I arranged a meeting the following evening on the Fleet's five-a-side tarmac football pitch. Eight came: Richie, Liam, Tez, Denny, Pete, Doxy, Bill, and Mark. From their first mutterings, it was clear they saw themselves as innocent victims of Fleet's corrupt setup, which used public money to make the sweet lives of the rich even sweeter, while local poor people got nothing. "Is that why the yoga man was attacked?" I asked. He was a mouthy wanker, one of them answered. And then, one at a time, and while the others watched from the sidelines, I walked them around and around the tarmac pitch, exploring one simple question. What do you want from Fleet, and what would you give in return? The thing they wanted above all others became apparent within minutes. Their own space in which to flop around and just be mates. I told them that some would see that as a reward for the yoga man being punched. They denied it would be that, and it would be especially bad, I said, if the nonsense behaviour carried on. It wouldn't, though, would it? Mark reasoned, because all of that is just us telling you we're here. If we've got our own space, there's no need. The real problem is, and I'm sorry about this, there's no space available for you. I bet there would be, came the response, if it was for some lefty bullshit. I'll show you something, I said, and led them to a shed at the rear of the building that used to be storage for the maintenance department, but which over the years had become somewhere to dump unwanted stuff. If you really want your space, this could be it, but you're going to have to clean it out, all the crap that's built up over the years, paint it and make it fit for use. It's got to be up to recognised standards. There was a moment's silence, while imperceptible signals passed between them. We could do that, Tez said finally. No fucking trouble. This was beginning to feel like a coffee bar movie of the 1950s, with me as the trendy vicar who jolly well understands young people. There'd be a worry about things getting out of control, I said to them. Paint chucked about and so on. I need to hear from you that the painting and cleaning will be done properly. How much are you getting paid for this? Doxy asked, giving me an ice-cutter stare. Whatever the amount was, I told him. So, in other words, Doxy continued, you're making money on the backs of us. But you're coming on like it's some big sacrifice. Load of bollocks, if you ask me. He turned his back on me to signal contempt. I made a little speech in response that went something like this.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
The station that makes you feel good.
The truth is, yes, I need money to live, which means work. This is work, and I get paid for it. But anyone who knows me knows that I want to do things that have a point to them. And the point about this is we have a problem. On the one hand, Fleet badly lets you down, as far as you're concerned. On the other, Fleet is fed up and nervous about what you're going to do next. I'm looking for a solution, and there is no solution without you. The shed, as it happens, could turn out to be the key to the whole thing. I was about to suggest they sleep on it when Mark declared, "We've decided. Might as well be a laugh anyway." An extra skip was booked, and encouragingly, most of them turned up for the big clear-out. They worked quickly, were raucous at times, but efficient. Tez said he could get some paint cheap from his decorator brother. There was then a squabble about which colours to use. I tried to suppress it, and did the same when they fell out about whether there should be an opening do and who should come. Then it struck me. The claiming, restoring, opening and functioning of the shed were perfect for revealing to them how they themselves would now need a formal means of decision-making and even sanctions. I asked Mark, Tez and Denny during a tea break what the shed would mean to them beyond it being their own space. "It's just a fucking shed," said Tez after a while. "There's no big reason." "So, are you easygoing about who uses it and how?" He was wearing an overlarge loose-knit sweater, jeans and boots. "Definitely not, man." He jabbed at his chest. "We fucking say who comes and who goes." "Who's we?" I asked. He looked at me pityingly. "If someone does come who shouldn't," I continued, "how should it be handled?" "Drop 'em down a well." "What happens if it's Billy's good mate?" "You've got to have real rules, man," Billy told Tez patiently. "Don't look at me like that," Tez told Billy. "Like what?" "Like I'm a cunt." "Well, you are a cunt." They were both smiling thinly. "Can we go easy on the language?" I asked. "I'll be accused of encouraging you." In the days that followed, I helped them discover that problems could be headed off and the smooth and safe running of the shed made more likely by introducing some basic rules. This included a formal declaration of what the shed is for and how it's to be run, and also some words on the ruling group and how its members were to be appointed and sat. Three or four of us worked on these, usually in the shed itself, between coats of paint and the introduction of final touches, such as rugs, furniture, and cleaned-up electrics. The declaration of what the shed is was neatly written out in ruby ink by Billy's big sister. A photocopy was posted on Fleet's main notice board. The list of 10 rules went on the shed door. Around 24 friends of the boys were invited to the opening. I insisted everyone be signed in, and it kind of happened. I also said that Fleet's no alcohol ruling had to be strictly observed, but all I could do was prevent obvious drinking and carrying of booze. Losing control on the alcohol front certainly demonstrated the limits of my influence over this group. But with the presence among them of the undisguised skeptic like Doxy, my jolly decent happy ending was always under threat. In fact, Doxy was a conventional teenage malcontent compared with the unsmiling Richie, who you'd catch staring at you with cold fascination as though you were a clever mechanical toy whose inner workings he was determined to get at. He was physically small and slight, but his good friend Mark suggested he had a taste for sudden, random violence that he would indulge during weekend evenings. Shed life itself was largely free of violence and threats. It was becoming what we'd hoped for in the beginning, a drop-in for contemplation as well as for animated exchanges. That was the surface experience. In the background were unfathomable dramas, signalled by urgent whispers, worried faces, and sudden rushed departures. 5 weeks after the shed's launch on a Saturday morning, Anne Stewart called me at home. "The shed had been trash," she said. "Could I come in?" I found chairs broken in pieces, a mirror smashed, paint thrown everywhere, windows caved in, and the delightful clincher, a considerable amount of human faeces in a corner, but in full view. We feared what revenge might look like. In fact, we suspected it was being pursued at that very moment. None of the shed group had come in, even though Anne, through phone calls, had let several of them know what had happened. The following morning, I discovered the truth. Members of the shed group themselves were responsible. Mark, who said he did not personally take part, acted as an explainer for those who did. To the obvious question, why? Given that the shed was their own impressive creation and into which they had poured so much effort, Mark answered, "Why not? It's a good laugh." Was I missing something? Laugh? Then maybe laugh, for alienated types like Mark and Richie, is what the Turner Prize crowd call art. On that basis, we could make a triptych out of it, before, during and after the facial deluge, and promote it as an absurdist statement on the futility of existence and how everything returns to disorder. Yes, we could call it entropy, or excuse the mess, it's only entropy. Going home that evening and seeing Davy in all his shiny innocence was a tonic. We discussed his toys and books, and I asked him to show me his five favourites and describe what he liked about them most, starting with number five and counting down to number one. I suspect what it was really about was the status of the shed itself. It began in their minds as a statement of independence and power. But once they got it, they saw it as a domesticity trap that sapped their strength. So they rebelled and destroyed it, comprehensively, and shat on it to make the point. What survived in them? I hope it was a memory of the value of cooperation, but who knows? What I can say is that during the time of the shed, the immediate problem of disorder and threats to the other centre users was absent. Mark, Tez, Pete, Richie, Doxy and co. returned to Flea only occasionally, and then only in ones and twos. They no longer had the appetite for mob posturing. They were growing up. I next took on part-time evening posts at the Alexander Road Youth Club, located in a huge brutalist residential estate not far from Abbey Road Music Studio. It comprised one large room on an upper level of a housing block and had a regular attendance of around 50 youngsters, male and female, aged 14 to 17. Whereas the Fleet youth were, in the main, simply willful and awkward, some of the Alex crowd were already sniffing from spray cans. They were also sold on the message and methods of the then-rampant far-right British movement, part of whose reputation was for street fighting and mob attacks on small vulnerable groups of non-whites. BM graffiti was all over the estate. Alex kids who followed that trail were near the bottom of the cultural and social heap. But even though the nation had lavished on them nothing discernible, their blood devotion to the idea of England and its innate superiority was such that they'd carve the emblems of loyalty into their flesh. The flag of St. George and the letters, ER. I watched him wonder one evening as a 15-year-old rested his wrist on a table at the back of the room and went to work with a Stanley knife. The solvent-sniffing issue was a constant, due to the vivid hallucinatory effects that could be triggered by the volatile chemicals found in unlikely places, such as pain relief spray, typewriter correction fluid, and fire extinguishers. A user might dream himself into the persona of an avenging superhero, or see the floors and walls alive with snakes and monkeys. Both experiences were described to me by those who went through them. Overtly stoned kids would be turned away at the door, and anyone found in a stoned condition inside would be told to leave, except for the comprehensively intoxicated, because turning them out would be reckless. There was, happily, more to it than sniffed fire extinguishers, fascism, and scary kids. They played hours of football to an impressive standard on an apron of concrete outside the main room. There was also a snooker table, a table tennis table and chocolate, crisps and toasted sandwiches from the club's own snack bar. And there was some laughter and conversation. I had made up my mind from the first evening that, despite the advanced schooling in bigotry some of them had received via the British movement, I wouldn't conceal my Jewish heritage. If anyone asked, I'd tell them. And so it happened with a boy who had been difficult to reach by the staff, but with whom a game of table tennis proved the gateway to more games of table tennis, and to what eventually amounted to sparse conversation. One evening, in relation to a film he'd been shown at school about the Nazis' persecution of the Jews, he began wisecracking about grannies in ovens. I told him it wasn't very funny, and he, of course, said he thought it was, and when he said, "You're not a Jew, are you?" And I said, "Yes." There was another reference to Jews in Nazi ovens, this time alluding to my family. It was an interesting moment. After some further exchanges designed on his part to wind me up, I paused and looked at him coldly. "I am a youth worker paid to do a job," I said. but I'm also a person with feelings and will accept only so much. Then I will react. If he had responded with more malice, I might have been sunk, but he fell silent. He had discovered there was a limit to my patience, a limit to the amount of crap I would take from him. We had previously been getting on fine, but now that was over. I continued at Alexander Road for several more months, but by now the freelance journalism was picking up. This was 1980, and with Margaret Thatcher getting into her stride, the political temperature was rising. NME was receptive to substantial pieces from me that hit the right socio-political spot. One looked at Northern Ireland politics from the street-level vantage point of the Undertones rock group, whose hometown was Derry. An English soldier who'd been posted to Northern Ireland also had a compelling story to tell, and there was a lengthy exploration of the fledgling Green movement, about which more people at the time knew nothing. I was also starting to make headway with mainstream national dailies and weeklies, even though the commissions from them were for small pieces on big topics. By the spring of 1981, I was feeling confident that things were beginning to fall nicely into place when there came a sudden reminder of what ultimately counts in life. Throughout the night of March 31st, Davy was repeatedly sick. The next morning, his GP told us to bring him to his surgery straight away. All the signs, he said, pointed to appendicitis. He phoned the nearby Royal Free Hospital and told us to get Davy there without delay. He was still in his pyjamas. The hospital doctors were at first sceptical and then strongly resistant to the appendicitis diagnosis. They said they will keep him overnight for monitoring. Sarah and I left for home, feeling unsettled by a suddenly far less certain situation. The night was long. At 5 a.m. we decided to phone. When put through to his ward, I heard a child in the background moaning in distress. When the nurse told me that this was Davy, we were down there at his side within minutes. Davy rarely cried audibly. He was an expressive, exuberant boy, but also a stoic. A teenage girl in the bed opposite told us he'd been in a distressed state all night, but had received no attention. His lips were dry and cracked through lack of water, but they continued withholding fluids in case it was suddenly decided he'd needed surgery, during which water in the system could be dangerous. But deciding to operate because of evolving symptoms requires observation of the patient, whereas Davy was being ignored. It was then we told him we would stay by his bed until he was better. By the following morning, the doctors were more convinced than ever that appendicitis was not the problem. Whatever it was, it would reveal itself soon enough through the development of symptoms. But meanwhile, they were focused on what they said was his constipation, even though we told them his bowel movements had always been healthy. They discounted this and inserted suppositories into his backside, thereby magnifying his pain. Water was now allowed, but he was too ill to drink. Always a lean boy, he was looking alarmingly skinny and drained of colour. We pressed them to operate, but their resistance continued. A young doctor even refused to acknowledge that Davy was in real pain because he was not writhing. Writhing in response to deliberately induced pain, I was to discover, is a standard way of grading pain in laboratory experiments on mice and rats. Davy was too ill to writhe, Sarah told the doctor. By day three, we were doing bedside shifts, going home in turn to clean up and sleep a couple of hours. Davy still had not had water, and our fears for him were growing. At last, they agreed to operate, but they still weren't convinced it was appendicitis. But that is precisely what it was. He was away for hours, and I feel certain that the appendix ruptured just before or during the operation itself, causing infection to spread throughout his abdomen. Peritonitis. This is a life-threatening development that calls for the cleaning of the abdominal cavity to prevent infection spreading uncontrollably. There was never an acknowledgement that peritonitis developed. No explanation was offered, despite our questions. Instead, one of the doctors told me bitterly that the complications Davy endured were my fault. because I'd interfered with his treatment. The opposite was the truth. Sarah has said a number of times over the years that Davy would be dead if I had not challenged the irrational, neglectful, and sometimes plain spiteful treatment he was receiving. One of the night nurses, for instance, recorded that Davy had enjoyed a comfortable second night when Sarah and I were there to see that he was distressed and in pain throughout. But comfortable was the message communicated to the day doctor, a description that presumably would influence clinical decisions. Then there was the pre-med a nurse gave him prior to being wheeled away for the operation. The needle was stabbed into him with such force his body lifted off the bed and large tears rolled silently down his face. We had been right to press for an end to the waiting. Our GP, who had been Davy's doctor from when he was 4 years old, recognised at once that he was suffering acute appendicitis, and the textbooks are clear about the risk of delaying. The appendix can rupture as quickly as 48 to 72 hours after the onset of symptoms. After 48 hours, the risk rises dramatically. Davy's symptoms were precisely what the textbooks describe, and the length of time he bore those symptoms before they decided to operate was more than 55 hours. They held on to Davy for another 7 days, the recovery period, during which he had an intensive course of antibiotics. We stayed at his bedside for all those days, leaving him only the final 2 nights after his last injections. When he first returned from surgery, he needed a wheelchair and drip rehydration. Other than the tiniest amount, water by mouth would have caused him to vomit. Sarah gave him 1 teaspoon every hour. It is astonishing how quickly children recover. Reg took him to a friend's big house in the Irish countryside. Davy had arrived in Ireland, skinny, white-faced, and enfeebled. He returned a week later looking as though he had never been sick. Sarah and I were never the same after the Raw Free experience. We saw how calamitous these grand-scale institutions can be for the individual, designed as they are to assert the primacy of the institution itself. Those who serve the institution strain to ensure that it reaches prescribed levels of performance, as measured by patient throughput and economic efficiency. The young doctor who blamed me for what Davy went through no doubt came at me weighed down by his own considerable frustrations. He would have seen me as one more irritant who didn't recognise how much it was all costing him. He, on the other hand, failed to grasp that Sarah and I were there not for the glorification of the Raw Free Hospital and its institutional goals, but to ensure Davy was healed rather than harmed. A week after we took him home, someone was found dead in one of those hospital toilets. He had been there undiscovered for 3 days. Were those toilets simply not clean during that time? This was quite likely. The training of cleaning staff was obviously not a priority. When I stopped a cleaner from musing on Davy's food tray, a wet cloth she had just been using in a toilet cubicle, she seemed puzzled. After the battle of Davy's appendix, there was a cascade of changes in our lives. Most important was the decision to go vegetarian. I also began to reconsider what I thought I knew about the allied themes of medicine, science, and sickness. If the Raw Free demonstrated the primacy of the institution, a report I read in that same year of 1981 called Bitter Pills revealed in plain terms the lengths which some global drug companies and their political and commercial allies were prepared to go to sabotage attempts by the poorest nations on earth to introduce a rational and affordable medicines prescribing policy. The report's author said there were at least 25,000 different drugs on the global market, many of them useless or harmful. The World Health Organization concludes that 200 basic drugs are all that is needed to treat the majority of world disease. When Bangladesh sought to introduce a policy in line with World Health Organization recommendations, it faced threats of disinvestment and economic and political isolation. Among those who pitched in to defend the interests of the multinationals were the British High Commission, A UK government health spokesman explained that they could not support the Bangladesh plan because there are aspects of the new Bangladeshi policy which are causing concern to the pharmaceutical industry. These were some of the thoughts that engrossed me following the battle of Davy's appendix. It was the start of something I knew I wouldn't let go of, even though we were probably headed for choppy waters.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Fleet Street. The worst curry I ever had was in a restaurant opposite King's Cross Station. It was a pale green stalky thing containing mixed meats and tasted sour, but not so sour that a hungry person wouldn't eat it. The second most awful came many years later from a grimy restaurant with food-stained menus in Deptford, South London. I chanced it because I was late for a date with the police. 45 minutes after placing my order, it had been gulped down and I was slipping into the back seat of a Metropolitan Police area car, whose call name was Papa 7. Area cars are the rapid response 999 vehicles, with sirens screaming, "Out of my way!" as they set about their high-speed chases. I was working on a feature about the Met for Time Out magazine, trying to assess its corporate mood and hear what experienced people within and outside the force were saying. Papa 7 would help me soak up the night shift atmosphere. We cruised for a few minutes before something came over the radio and the driver's foot went down on the accelerator. We turned a corner at speed, tilting at an alarming angle. At once, I regretted the curry. We were 6 minutes into a six-hour shift, and already I felt queasy. I looked at the neatly turned-out yard press officer beside me and had a scary vision of him being splashed by my half-digested curry coming up at speed. The back of our driver's head, I didn't dare think about. I held on. I had to. Asking them to pull over would have given them more fun than they deserved. That first emergency turned out to be a prank. But at 10 p.m. there was a genuine emergency call asking us to attend an incident at a pub. What happened next summed up relations in 1986 between the Met and those on the ever-widening margins of city life. A young man who believed he had been unfairly bounced from the pub returned with a bread knife, with which he was intent on registering his complaint on the landlord. Papa 7, its siren wailing, screeched to the doorstep, and the driver, his operator, the yard press officer, and I strode purposefully through the front door into a large plain-looking room. No covering on the wooden floor, no padding in the chairs. The door was closed behind us, and though it sounds too corny to be true, the pool game stopped. One of the players picked up a cue ball and held it lightly in his palm. A ball like that, I thought, could do damage if directed at someone's head. The man with the bread knife was no longer on the premises, but his mother was. She was the one shouting at the landlord, egged on by two young male family members. But soon her fire was redirected at us cops. The mood of the place, with its near all-black clientele, hardened. We slipped outside, ostensibly for the Papa 7 crew to calm the complaint. But in reality, it felt like a retreat for our lives. "Don't talk to them, Mum," one of the men told the woman, gesturing in our direction. "We've tried talking to them for years, and where does it ever get us? Except stitched up. It's in one fucking ear and out the other." He spat out some more invective, and then suddenly slowed and looked weary. A cue for the men from the Met to return to Papa 7. We were soon back in the old routine, the numbing rush through dark streets, bending around corners, slicing through traffic, and invariably getting there too late. The thief reported to be robbing a house had gone. The man in the dark coat seen with a shotgun had probably never existed. The gang of toughs trying car doors and bullying passers-by had melted away, and, with other area cars, the slower pandas, and sometimes a transit van rushing simultaneously to some of the same small-scale dramas, the sense of futility at seeing so much enforcement hardware assembled to no purpose was overwhelming. My employer, Time Out, was in those days a semi-rebellious leftish weekly that was on permanent watch for the zeitgeist. I was called news features editor and was given time, precious weeks if needed, to work up pieces that it was hoped would linger in the memory. Typical was that investigation of the Met. There was also an undercover report on the British far right and its ideological brethren in Italy. Another was the epic story of the African elephant, Pol Pol, who was captured as an infant in the wild and fell into the hands of the blimps and nitwits running London Zoo. Her story so moved people that it was instrumental in the founding of what was to become the Born Free Foundation. There are also pieces drawn from my book, Street Drugs, which was published shortly before I joined Time Out. If I were the boastful type, I would make it known that Street Drugs was described by the most on-trend magazine of its day, The Face, as the most cool-headed and penetrating account yet of recreational drug use and its pioneers and profiteers through the ages. For the Institute for the Study of Drug Dependence, it was a drug worker's Bible. I was keen to write about drugs because ever since returning to England from California, I'd been hearing a lot of stiff-backed, cheek-sucking cant coming from official sources about what drugs are and what they do to people who abuse them. The message seemed to be, drug taking is bloody awful. You'll get ill and maybe die if you do it, so don't. Be sensible. The obvious danger with that approach is that if the first-time user discovers what is deliciously enticing about some drugs, the melting away of old anxieties, the waves of sensory pleasure, the imagination cracking out of its shell and flying free, it is from then on that everything about the official version is disbelieved, including the bits that are useful. NME agreed to a series of articles describing what drug use truly looked and felt like in Britain in that year of 1984. I wasn't an expert, I didn't have shelves of books on the subject, but I had sampled all the commonly used substances by mouth and nose. I'd had both good and bad times doing it, and I was ready to go places and talk to anyone, dealer, user, priest, cop, schoolteacher, to get an up-close view of what was going on. I fixed up some appointments and started, first Liverpool, then Manchester, Glasgow, Edinburgh, back to London, and then Brighton on the south coast, and finally Cardiff. I could have chased around more towns, but thought it better to go deeper into fewer places. I spoke with medics, police and politicians, parents mourning the loss of a child, specialists running treatment and support units, as well as users and dealers. One of the many formidable characters I met, the most desperate to do good deeds, were addicts who'd once been considered a lost cause, but who came back from the dead and now cursed their wasted years. Someone who was in desperate need of good deeds was a Glasgow working girl, maybe 18 years old, I saw trying to reel in clients in a part of the city where two of her fellow sex workers had recently been stalked and beaten up. I asked why she didn't get off the streets. She gave a little involuntary shiver, signifying that they wouldn't let her. Her lips were cracked, and her hands fluttered nervously as she spoke. There was nothing of her, no flesh on her bones. She told me her name was Mary and that there was no choice but to work on the streets. She illustrated that with a little ironic forward thrust of her skinny hips, the droop in her black leather-style trousers emphasizing her emaciated frame. "Lovey," she said in a whisper, "just let me have a pound or two so I can get myself straight. Promise I'll get it back to you." "That's a fair exchange," I told her, "for the help you've given me." A binge reading of specialist journals, reports and parliamentary debates gave me the additional information I needed, and I got down to writing. It was run over two issues of NME and seemed to go down well. A few weeks later, the publisher, Hodder and Stoughton, made contact and asked me to write a book along the same lines, only more of it. Street Drugs, the book, was clearly a larger and more complex task. 12 categories of mood-changing substances would each have their own chapter, and each chapter would be divided into segments covering such things as sensations, experience, medical impact, pharmacology, the law, culture, history, and where to get help. The practical guide element meant it could be directly useful to people. It also, in that way, went beyond the realm of social anthropology, or, as it's known in non-specialist circles, prying into other people's lives. Much of my journalism, in fact any journalism, is about peering voyeuristically into the affairs of others and then darting your subjects with impertinent questions. It's a privileged position to be in, and you do find yourself in places amongst people you'd never otherwise meet. I'd been hearing, for example, during the late stages of Street Drugs research, that an increasing number of women users of heroin were turning to dealing as a way of gaining better control over their lives. Some were shifting quantities of heroin sufficient to attract the attention of serious villains. In this category was Laura, who was turning over several ounces a day when I met her. She saw her heroin dealing as a branch of the healing arts. "You don't turn people away," she told me, "if they're ill and short of cash. You fix them up and hope for fair recompense." Her clients cut across the social spectrum, from scaffolders to city brokers. Sometimes 8 or 9 of them would be thrown together in her front parlour, waiting for their score. Her dealing, she acknowledged, had put her in a position of power, which was a dangerous niche for a woman to occupy in a world where there was no authority to turn to if things got out of control. Perhaps one of her clients, resentful of her hold over his appetite, tipped off the gang that first called by in the summer of 1981. "They came bursting in," she said, claiming at first they were the police. "They took 1/2 ounce each of heroin and cocaine, £1,000 in cash, and emptied the pockets of her clients. They came back several times, and in addition to their knives, which were transported in a blue zipper bag, they produced a shotgun. It got particularly appalling for my daughter," Laura told me. "She became so well trained that as soon as she heard a knock on the door, she dived under the bed and stayed there until they were gone." Like many women dealers with children, Laura, who was middle class, elegant, even after all those years of smack, and not yet 30, said she was drawn to the trade because it promised both a regular personal fix and economic self-sufficiency. What kept her at it was the heroin itself. Still, her life's great longing. But that's what the love of it will do, make slaves of those it enraptures. Heroin didn't always have such grandiose pretensions. When it was first introduced, it was as a possible answer to something medicine had sought for a long time, a safe, non-addictive painkiller come sedative. The opium poppy had been used in Britain for 300 years for that purpose, but it was displaced by a supposedly superior modern alternative, morphine. Though 10 times more potent than opium, it was sold as a cure for the opium addicted. But while it might have banished all desire for opium, for many users this was replaced by a craving for morphine itself. Then came heroin, which, incredibly, was said to be able to cure morphine addiction. And after heroin came methadone, the state-sanctioned replacement drug for heroin addicts. But methadone is not only addictive. Withdrawing from it is considered tougher and more protracted than coming off heroin. You'd need the giddy heart of a Pollyanna to imagine that the journey from opium to methadone was undertaken by the medicine makers with philanthropic intent. I don't say there was a written down boardroom plot, but to fail to anticipate problems ahead when substituting a dangerous drug with another derived from the same source and which is ounce for ounce more potent is evidence either of reckless optimism or institutional cynicism. Why haven't government drug regulators kept a proper lookout on behalf of the public? The governments I've seen come and go have been more interested in the business of medicine than the art of healing. In dopey marketing speak, their priority is to facilitate biomedical innovation and the flourishing of British talent in a competitive healthcare marketplace. It became clear soon after I began researching the TO piece on the Met that Britain's premier police force was not in good health. It was even evident in that night shift with Papa Seven as they raced around southeast London, sick with ambition but getting little in the way of results. An arrest is the only result most coppers understand, I was told by an East London PC. But in Deptford, the night I joined the crew, as during most others, there were few of them. For the whole of London, the clean-up rate for crime was just 7%, the worst in the country. And there were other clues pointing to the crumbling of the force's once impregnable ramparts. False morale, according to an internal poll, was poor and getting worse. One authority I spoke to, an ex-inspector with the Met's notorious Special Patrol Group, said it was the lowest he'd witnessed in 25 years. The litany of troubles was long. Opinion polls showed that public confidence in the force was at rock bottom. Police tactics were being questioned, even by the Daily Telegraph. Accusations from the public of police bullying and thuggishness were on the rise. And, critically, there were signs of a growing divide between junior and senior ranks. The active juniors were fed up being used as an easy target whenever the Met was under fire and wanted an end to what they saw as soft policing. The senior officers, on the other hand, that's commander level and above, were desperate to stem the tide of police bully boy media stories. Looking back on that moment, it's clear that the source of the animus between the two sides was October the 6th, 1985, the night on which police and local males fought each other at the troubled Brawlwater Farm housing estate in Tottenham, North London. The confrontation was still raw in the memory of many Londoners when I came to write my piece on the Met 1 year later. The battle had been vicious and unsparing and left those constables and sergeants who were there on the night with an indelible sense of betrayal at what they saw as the incompetence and cowardice of those in command. It was a hurt felt by the active ranks right across the Met, not least because of the global headlines the confrontation prompted and its portrayal in some quarters as a sorry defeat, a humbling for the London police. Inevitably, the reason for the confrontation is disputed. The consensual police view was that it was a culmination of long festering problems on the farm, caused by lawless youth who wanted control over the estate to rule it for their own ends. Most community leaders describe something very different, a campaign of systematic police intimidation and harassment of the kind black people in Britain had faced for decades. What was not disputed was that as October the 6th approached, there was an air of growing unease, with reports almost daily of physical attacks on police and cars being set on fire. The trigger was almost certainly the death of farm resident Cynthia Jarrett, who suffered a heart attack when police raided her home in a fruitless search for stolen goods. I reported at the time that a contingency battle plan was drawn up and logged at Wood Green Divisional Headquarters. It rested on seizing the walkways before neutralising the entire estate. The moment to have done this, officers later realised, was during a lull in the afternoon following the first heated response to the death of Cynthia Jarrett. Instead of seeing their walkways seized and finding themselves on the back foot, the youths had a chance to assemble. 1,500 police from all over London also assembled, and with machetes, bricks and petrol bombs hurtling into their ranks. They were told not to advance, but to hold firm. Senior men, whose only experience of street battle was from the safety of a map room, were apparently arguing with each other over the airwaves. Inspectors, the rank who commanded the shield serials or units of 20 officers, were said to be either paralysed with indecision or furious with orders from higher up to stand their ground. A PC who was there on the night told me, "They lost their bottle completely. It was down to the sergeants and PCs themselves to do what they thought was right at the time. I did see one superintendent on the estate, but he soon left. He just jumped in the car and fled for his life." As I say, my Met article was published a full 12 months after the Battle of Broadwater Farm. But the question that still reverberated was this one. Why, if it was unsafe for 1,500 police to enter the farm, was PC Keith Blakelock sent in as part of a unit of fewer than a dozen constables? That unit was forced to run when a group of 30 or 40 locals came at them. Blakelock stumbled, fell, and was frenziedly set upon, receiving more than 40 injuries, inflicted by machetes or similar, and was found with a 6-inch-long knife rammed deep into his neck. Lack of leadership, loss of nerve by senior officers, and muddled lines of communication seemed to characterise the Met's performance at Broadwater Farm. Communication problems were evident a year later during my night spent racing around South London in Papa 7. When cars were directed to go to a particular location, they were given virtually no information over the radio about the kind of incident they were rushing to, and therefore what backup, if any, was needed. I recall Papa 7 arriving in a suburban street to deal with what turned out to be a man threatening his wife with a knife. A serious business, but there was already an area car, a panda, and a district support unit van ready to deal with it. Yet at the next job, the last of the night, there was the reverse situation. A youth rampage or riot had occurred on rough ground inside an estate and had only just blown itself out. That was just as well, since it was only the driver of the van I'd been switched to who answered the call, and me, and I didn't count. My profile of the Metropolitan Police did not go down well with New Scotland Yard. A deputy assistant commissioner I had interviewed for the piece wrote my editor a long point-by-point complaint about its many shortcomings and chastised me for not quoting more of his ruminations. But the failings, organisational weaknesses and internal tensions I described were real, serious and added up to, in the words of the headline, crisis at the Met.
That was My Life as an Animal by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith. Produced by Tom Davidson and adapted for UK Health Radio by Monkey Nut Audiobooks. My Life as an Animal is available on Audible and audiobook sites. Be sure to tune in next time to hear more from this title. This audiobook is published by Monkey Nut Audiobooks in Hampshire, UK.